This week on Retronauts, more Puff Puff than you can stand. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I am your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and today's topic is Dragon Quest XI. Before I talk more about that, who is here in the room with me today on this lovely Saturday on the eve of SantaCon?
I didn't realize it was the eve.
Yeah, it's SantaCon's eve.
Oh, wow.
And you got me a gift.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yes, I bought you your own sexy Santa. Hi, this is Jeremy Kingslime Parrish.
And who else is here today?
Ooh, darling, it's Henry Gilbert, Princey Pooh.
Wow, we got a couple of characters in this room. And yeah, today we're talking about Dragon Quest XI, and in the past, I would say maybe a year or 18 months of Retronauts, we have looked at, modern games. People yell at me when I talk about the PlayStation 2 or GameCube, but sometimes we talk about things like Mario Odyssey and Breath of the Wild. And
I was on both those.
Yeah, well, you're a ringer for these, Henry. But yes, today we're talking about Dragon Quest XI because it is the newest Dragon Quest, and there is no series more traditional than Dragon Quest, I think, just period. This is the most traditional gaming series ever invented.
Maybe the Anno series of strategy games.
Yes,
maybe,
but
that's more traditional.
I'm not going to play that to find out at all. But yeah, I feel like this is a great topic because Dragon Quest is really, really a series that sticks to tradition more than anything else, as I said before. And this is the most modern version of Dragon Quest to date and is also very, very traditional at the same time. And it's going to be interesting to talk about how those two different philosophies mesh up. Before we begin, though, I want to just have all of our qualifications on the table so all the listeners can judge us. What is our Dragon Quest XI experience to date so far? And as of this recording, it's still a fairly new game. I have the least experience in that I've only played 90 hours of it. So
no, actually, you're ahead of me.
Oh, I am. Okay. Well, you've actually finished the game.
I kind of rushed through. Yeah.
Yeah, but
I only spent 82 hours with it.
Oh, lame.
What a couple of losers I got here. I had 125 hours in roll credits on the true ending as well.
That's true, yes. So just like with a lot of Japanese games and like previous Dragon Quest games, there is an ending for normies who only have 100 hours. And then there is a special ending that is the true ending that you get after you play like the 30-hour epilogue. And Henry has achieved that goal. Have you platinumed this game? How many hours more would you have to spend?
No, I think it's more like a 200-hour platinum. I mean, with guides and stuff, it can take you to all of the things. It's a completable one. You just have to set aside all the time.
Yeah.
I could maybe set aside the 40 to 50 hours it would take to platinum it. But by the time I got the second credit, so I was like, I really should play something else now.
Yeah, when I started this game, I had plans to get a platinum. Now I'm not so sure about where my life is going if I just devote that much of it to Dragon Quest XI. It would not be a good decision. But yeah, today's topic is Dragon Quest XI, Echoes of an Elusive Age, and it's a great game. I think we all like it. But before we get into the game itself, I want to talk about some of the more notable people behind it, and these people have not really changed. If you go back to our previous Dragon Quest episodes, you know we've talked about these guys a lot. I want to go over them really quickly. It's possible that you have not heard those past Dragon Quest episodes. And so the first dude is the Dragon Quest godfather, Yuji Horii. And he was basically the inventor of two different genres, unofficially, but basically the Japanese adventure game genre and the Japanese RPG. Although there are earlier examples of them, he sort of made the mold for those that everyone has taken off of. And yes, so Portopia was the Japanese adventure game and things like, you know, Danganronpa and Phoenix Wright and Hotel Dusk and things like that, those are all following in that fashion. And of course, you know, Dragon Quest, Final Fantasy came next, and everything is sort of following in the path of Dragon Quest in terms of Japanese role-playing games. But yeah, he's a very important creator up there with people like Will Wright, Shigeru Miyamoto. And unlike those guys, he's still like super, super hands-on with the individual games. He is not – I mean, he has sort of risen to management heaven, but based on the talent on these games and who actually directs them, I still feel like he is super, super into the development of making these games.
Yeah, I think he kind of micromanages a lot of the story and a lot of the mechanics and things like that. He's not – you know, like a producer type who just kind of sits back and is like, bring me status reports and I'll give you money. But more like, somewhere between producer and director, where he's not just like involved day to day, you know, like calling all the shots, but he definitely has veto power and is really, you know, concerned about the final product and the tone of the game and the nature of the game. So I feel all of that, you know, ultimately he kind of has the word on, you know, it's the sort of top-down management style in Japan that is very prevalent there. Like, you know, it's not just that he's calling the shots. He's also like there and making sure everything is up to his standards.
I think Hori is like ensconced in management power. Like he could never lose the job he has if he wants it forever. But he also didn't want to – he didn't move up the ladder at NX like, say, how Shigeru Miyamoto moved up the ladder at Nintendo to just a more executive level thing. I don't think that's what he was interested in. And it was interesting to me. I didn't realize until I read an interview for this how Hori kept the divide between him and NX for a bit. Like, he had Armor Project, which that was really his company. That was sort of a separate organization from NX.
And they would contract people like Chunsoft and Heartbeat and to make the games. Yeah,
yeah. But now Armor Project is basically doesn't exist anymore, and it's just internal production on the games. That was a big change from really 10 in, and then this one.
Yeah, it's, you know, some weird stuff kind of came out about Hori and his like the way his company is structured and everything. When he was like did an interview and he talked about how he got a divorce from his wife because of some infidelity. I don't know, like people kind of were like, oh, is that how that company works? It doesn't have anything to do with infidelity or divorce, just like it's a very like small company with only a few employees. So yeah, I think Armor Project is more like a management corporation, sort of like managing the property. I don't really know for sure, but yeah, it was kind of independent. Like everyone who worked for NX back in the day was pretty much independent, like all their development talent. So I think this is just a carryover from that.
Until they merged with Square, I don't think NX was ever like had their own development. It was always other studios doing it for them.
They might
right?
have had some internal talent, but yeah, they mostly contracted out. You mentioned Chunsoft. Koichi Nakamura basically was under full-time contract with NX to do programming and debugging and stuff for them throughout the 80s.
But Henry was saying that Hori didn't climb the ladder. I think he was always at the top of the ladder and the ladder just got bigger under him.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it because NX got that big because he was one of their first guys they published games with. So he was always on like the top floor and then just the skyscraper kept going up and up under him.
Yeah. And he was just a game creator. He was submitting games to magazines, magazine contests. That's really how he was discovered. We talk about that in the first Dragon Quest episode from like 2015, a long time ago. But
just a Shonen Jump editor.
Yeah.
That's so crazy to me.
That is great. But yeah, he's making more public appearances in America just because the series is getting bigger in America. He was at PAX when I was there in the PAX vicinity, signing things, meeting people. It's cool that he is being more public in America now that they're trying to make this a thing in America. And I'm pretty sure Dragon Quest now is just a thing in America that will just continue to exist. I think this is sort of like
– I hope so.
It doesn't feel like we're going to have another dry spell like we did after 9.
I guess it will depend on how well this game ultimately does. I've heard it didn't sell that well. But on the plus side, Nintendo has stepped in to say, oh, we're going to publish Dragon Quest Builders 2 in America. So
that's
we'll at
great.
Least get that one.
Yeah. So other people, unfortunately, we got to name this guy because he sucks. Koichi Sugiyama, just a terrible mummy and can't make music to save his own life.
The dummy
he
mummy.
He wrote some really good music 30
years
ago.
Yeah, but his brain is now just a pile of mush and it's mostly racism and homophobia. But yeah, I mean like before, I think even on previous podcasts, I would be like, you know, This is a man who was like a teenager during the war, and I'm sure that will change your opinions on things. But I'm just like, put Grandpa in the closet. It's okay. We don't need to hear from what he says anymore.
Yeah, there's racist old people are messing everything up for everyone around the world.
Yeah, that was recorded at a different time when I was like, you know what? Yeah, difference of opinion.
There
but
are
now
very
just,
fine people on both sides.
Yes, exactly.
But they're stuck with him for life. Until he retires, he has a job for life. So.
Well, I mean, does he have a job? Did he do anything for Dragon Quest XI? Every single track in this game is just a recycled Sugiyama track from a previous game, isn't it?
If his job is just recycling his old compositions, that's technically him doing
it. He didn't even do anything. It's just like they said, well, let's put this on some MIDI and let's go for it. Remember that great track from Dragon Quest II? Well, here you go.
There is new music in the game.
Oh, is there?
Yes, but then when you hear the old music, like, oh, thank God. The new music is just so – you can tell because it's just like, what would an 88-year-old man compose? It's like, I know how to play the scales still. That's how my brain works. And that's all it is. And it's really bad. And so we'll talk more about the music later. I hate to just jump into this now. But, yeah, the biggest sore spot in this game is that the music – not just the compositions are bad, but the instrumentation is just – appalling.
That was the thing that really frustrated me is that with Dragon Quest VIII, it had the same kind of musical quality on PS2, and when Square Enix localized it for the US, they were like, that ain't gonna fly. So let's go out and record full orchestrations for the Dragon Quest VIII soundtrack in the US. So we got a completely different soundtrack in America and in Europe than they got in Japan, and it was much better. It just sounded great. But
same
for,
is true of
7 11,
on 3DS. They used the orchestration version.
I thought they killed the orchestration in the US version.
Boy, I should really remember. I played 130 hours of that game.
I think they did, yeah.
Yeah,
actually, yeah. I think they cut that. But I'm saying with 8, like, it was a deliberate localization choice to go and re-record the entire soundtrack with an orchestra. And I get that Dragon Quest is very traditional, and the Dragon Quest fans really hate for Dragon Quest to change in any respect, and that is why they keep doing these MIDI soundtracks for these high-definition, gorgeous-looking games, but it doesn't fit and it doesn't fly in the West where people don't have that, like, knee-jerk compulsion to be like, ah, it's different, I hate it. And we're just like, oh, this sounds kind of bad and weird.
I think so this is Sugiyama. He owns the copyright on the music, and I think his intentionality is I want people to buy the orchestrated version or go to see the performances. I don't want you to get that in the video game version. I think that was what his intent was.
Old school
way. I mean, is that really – like, has he said that, or are you just extrapolating?
This is all slander and hearsay, okay. But I believe when
as long as we're clear that we're libeling right now.
When I read about this, I mean, that's not the worst libel you could say. Like, but
no, that was earlier.
I can make worse slander than that. Challenge me, please. But I believe that when that's come up, it's been his directive that has been like, no. That's why it was shut down for the 7 on 3DS. Just like, no, this is a special version of the music. But you know what? It's all on YouTube. Go look it up. It's all there. Like, I wanted to see, like,
he doesn't know what YouTube is.
Of course not.
Sugiyama has not heard of that.
People have modded the PC version of Dragon Quest XI so that you can download, like, an orchestration pack and just have, like, real music with Dragon Quest XI on PC.
That is really cool. And I will say the music does sound better orchestrated. The songs are still not great, but, you know, it is MIDI or MIDI. And my problem with that is you can do that, but it's just a cheap sounding sound font. It's not like a Super Nintendo sound font. It's not even like as good as like a Dragon Quest VIII sound font. It just sounds like just the cheapest, most generic off the shelf keyboard. It's grating. It's bad. And if you can at least. You can have like that sort of music, but it doesn't have to sound that bad. And that is just that, like, the only real negative spot we will all complain about in this game. And when people sometimes when you have a different opinion than me, or most of the time, because I'm becoming less of a toxic person when it comes to criticism, but it's just like sometimes I can be like, yes, I can see how you would have that opinion. I don't have that opinion, but I can see how you could have it. When people are online and saying, I don't get what you're saying about the music, it's not that bad. I'm like, no, you are insane.
I also buy into the assumption that it's Sugiyama choosing for it to be the non-orchestral because I can't imagine why they do it for any other reason than a man with a lot of legal sway in Japan is preventing them from doing it. There would be no other reason to not.
Yeah. And anyone else playing that game and making decisions would be like, this does not fit what this game looks like or how it plays. It just feels – again, you can have an older sounding soundtrack, but it just sounds bad. But
like I said, it's really incongruous with the rest of the game.
Yeah.
Because this is just a beautiful game to look at. The graphics are so nice and, you know, it's just such a warm – very, very fresh feeling game, and then this very, very stale sounding music just kills it. hate it.
Yeah.
And I love, you know, the classic Dragon Quest compositions, the town music and the field music and stuff, but it's done so jarringly badly here. It's frustrating.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the composition and orchestration, both are bad, but also just like the amount of music, he is still composing soundtracks as if this was an NES game where it's like, okay, we have a town theme, a castle theme, and an overworld theme, but it's like when the towns are so different in this game, you just want a different sounding town theme. It's just like now I'm in the very Japanese town. Oh, it's still the same town music from the first town. Like I just like the way he went about doing this, or the way the developers went about, you know, planning this music. I just feel like it is the one thing that really sticks out as a bad part of this game. I just want more music and better music. Akira Toriyama, of course. We talked a lot about him.
Woo!
You should know who he is if you are a nerd. Of course, he created things like Dragon Ball, Dr. Slump, and he was the artist behind the games like Chrono Trigger, and also he's the main artist behind Dragon Quest. And it's great. I mean, you can see all of his designs here. There's new ones. There is another person who assists him, and I looked up his name, but he's basically been the art director for Dragon Quest for like 2 decades, so well, just sort of like a proxy for him.
It's also why it's called like Bird Studio.
Yeah,
it's a lot of the time, and not just Toriyama.
Imagine that could be one of his assistants from like old manga projects or something like that.
I love Akira Toriyama. I have come to love him a lot more in the last year because I never had read the entire pre-DBZ Dragon Ball stuff until this year. When I read, I was like, this man is a genius.
He's hilarious.
Yeah.
Goku's the best.
Everything is funny. The action is great. The characters have some stuff not aged. Yeah, sure. But it's a really such a great comic. And what was also fun to read it as a Dragon Quest super fan was to see all these moments in it that I was then would later say, oh, wait, that was in a Dragon Quest that came out a year later, too. Like, this feels like a reference. There's actually about, I swear, 3 or 4 Dragon Ball references in Dragon Quest XI. I will shout out one directly here, which is when you first meet Rab in the tournament. But you don't know his name. You're being assigned to fight each other in the tournament. He is just standing to the side wearing a mask and smiling at you and not doing anything. That is exactly what Goku's grandfather does when he is in the fighting tournament against Yubaba to find out the location of Dragon Balls from her magic ball. It's the exact same posing from the same style
really?
Outfit guy. Like,
wow.
It is a direct reference.
Interesting. Wow. I've not read that far yet. I want to because original Dragon Ball is so good. But yeah, I think we were a little more cynical about him before, but I think there's like a new love for Dragon Ball Z and just the new love for Akira Toriyama now that people are sort of rediscovering his stuff again.
Fighters.
Oh, yeah.
Not FighterZ. That, I think, did really reignite a lot of passions for Dragon Ball. It reminded people, like, oh, this is why I loved Dragon
Ball.
Well,
and also Dragon Ball Super.
Yes.
That's gone over pretty well.
It has. And then Toriyama is more popular than ever in a Western front right now. A Dragon Quest game couldn't have come at a better time, I think.
And in recent memory, things like Dragon Ball Z Kai made the original animated series worth watching again, just like cutting out all the fat. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Jeremy.
No, it's fine. I mean, I talked about this, I think, a bit on the Dragon Ball game episode, but I recently read through the entirety of the original Dragon Ball, not just the original, but also Z, and came away really impressed because I had read some of the older stuff and I was like, ah, it's great. But then I was like, well, the Z stuff is stupid and it's just like angry people with veins screaming at each other. And I'd read like the first arc and it just went on forever. It was just like all this fighting. I can't do this for like 30 volumes. No way. But I finally read past that first arc and then there's a whole lot of story, a whole lot of world building, and it becomes a lot more nuanced. And I didn't realize any of that. But once I got past that, I was like, oh, okay. So occasionally there will be these extremely drawn out fights where everyone is basically like blowing up the planet. But then there's other stuff too that I, you know, that I like Toriyama for. Mm-hmm. So he's really good at kind of mixing the, you know, like cheeky humor, warm character design or development, and extremely big stories with high stakes and just very likable characters. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, yeah, great stuff. Even the Puff Puff is taken. That happened in Dragon Ball first. Puff Puff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I think that was another reference. The last thing I want to say about Toriyama that I learned this time in prep for this was I had heard the story before that Hori himself had said about how they, you know, they teamed up because they both worked on Shonen Jump, and he joined to help. He was a fan of the detective game, and so he wanted to make designs for his other game, for his next game. But he then, in this new interview, he revealed it was also Toriyama's editor was kind of pushing him to do to try to get him to hit deadlines better. He's just like, well, if you do this, will you do – like that's – I just read this whole – another Shonen Jump series, Bakuman, which a large part of it is about how editors abuse, trick, cajole, and compliment artists just to get their pages in because the deadlines are beastly.
I think Toriyama's editor eventually became a character in Dr. Slump or was drawn into Dr. Slump a lot. He's got like big poofy hair, or well, he used to. He probably doesn't anymore.
Well, his editor is a big part of why like the Cell Saga has like five villains in it, because every time the editor was like, that's not an old man with a beard and a fat guy? No, that's not it. Like, and they just kept having a new big bad until he finally, the editor was satisfied.
Goku should fight two cool 90s teens in this robot 90s teens. Last guy I want to talk about is the actual director of the game, Takeshi Uchikawa. Looking at his credits list, it's very, very short. And I feel like, not to take anything away from this guy, I feel like he was just sort of a proxy for Hori, because Hori is like in his 60s and he can't do everything on his own. So I feel like this is the guy that's sort of like his second in command that is, you know, in the trenches for the most part.
He's doing the 70-hour weeks.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So his body is still young and pliable and abusable. So the credits I found for him were just like two. And maybe there's more. Maybe it wasn't, you know, documented very well. But he had a role in the scenario of Dragon Quest IX and Dragon Quest Monsters Joker 2. So that's basically it. I don't know how old he is or anything like that, but he seems like a fairly new person in the world of game development. Maybe just someone that Hori trusts a lot, or someone he has a lot in common with, or is just very easy for him to work with, or just he listens.
Could be. You know, I heard that I read somewhere online that the application process for writing for Dragon Quest was that they asked people to submit a fairy tale, like to write a fairy tale for them. So I feel like this guy must have some sort of like natural feel for that sort of, you know, like vignette style storytelling. And I will say that Dragon Quest XI does a really interesting job with its kind of like the self-contained narrative arcs, because it carries on that tradition that started really with, I don't know, what, Dragon Quest 6, 7?
I think where even you go, 4 with the four chapters.
To a little bit, but I mean much more so in like 6, 7, 8, 9, where you go to a different place and there is a story that takes place like in its entirety within that setting. And they do a good job of kind of twisting your expectations. Like you're like, well, you know, this is a pretty boilerplate story. I know where this is going. And then it goes in a direction you don't expect. And then, you know, you kind of get used to that, like saying, oh, what's the twist here? And then they just play it straight. So they really do a good job with this, the writing in Dragon Quest XI, with always kind of, I wouldn't say keeping you on your toes, but everything feels familiar, and then you don't necessarily know what the end is going to be. Like, how is this going to turn out? So it keeps what could be, you know, very generic and cliche from feeling that way, because it always has an outcome that is maybe not what you expect. And I really, really appreciate that. So if that is the work of what was his name?
Takeshi Uchikawa.
If that's Uchikawa's contribution to the game, then he did a great job.
Hmm. Oh, there was one last name I thought of in this too, that the series executive producer who is kind of oversees all Dragon Quest stuff usually is
– He gives a lot of interviews, right?
Yu Miyake.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, Miyake. Yeah. He was in a couple of my Dragon Quest interviews, and he kind of – I think he is just the general planner of not just the numbered games but the many, many spinoffs too, and just oversees all of that within the Square Enix family.
Talk about the game itself. It came out in Japan in July of 2017, in America in September of 2018. So just like with every Dragon Quest game of this vintage, it takes about a good year for all the localization stuff to happen because they're adding voice work, they're tweaking stuff, they're adding a run button, which is like, how did you play this game without just always jamming on that run button?
Well, in, you know, with like, say, Pokemon or Final Fantasy, they realized a long time ago we have to be doing localization concurrently with development. But for Dragon Quest, but that is a huge, you know, resource intensive thing to do. For Dragon Quest, it's not worth that kind of thing. So they want to ship their game first and then start working on localization. It just it has to go on the back burner pretty much every time.
I was reading interviews with Hori, and I don't know if this was a pleasant lie or a real fact, but they were asking him, you know, why doesn't the Japanese version have voice work? And they basically said, well, Mr. Hori likes to have last minute changes to things a lot. So, you know, voice work wouldn't be accommodating for that. And that could be true. Hmm. And that also could be why they can't work on localizations simultaneously. But I think in another interview, he has been thinking about, doing localization work while the game is in development because of how in this game characters have different names depending on the region. And he kind of now wants that to be, you know, one name across the board. So maybe not a main character named Homer. That would not work in an American game.
I could see him being so mercurial that he is just like, I'm going to change this name. That dialogue doesn't feel good to me anymore. I know it ships in 2 weeks, but change that line. I could see that.
Yeah, not having voice work isn't that power. So it's like, yeah, we don't have to re-record anything. Just, you know, change what this character says via text. Mm-hmm. But once the game is finished and out in Japan, of course, they can just, okay, let's voice act all of this. He's not going to make any more changes. It's out. It's a finished game.
We've hit final cut. Though, yeah. I mean, he is actually pretty, according to him in interviews too, which could also be pleasant lies. He is pretty invested in the localization of it compared to, I don't know. I would say, like, I would bet Hajime Tabata was pretty invested in the localization of Final Fantasy 15 as well. But Hori seems a lot more invested in them getting especially the humor right and the tone,
yeah,
which a lot of the pre-Dragon Quest 8 games didn't really get.
There were some funny interviews with him, especially recently. I was reading – they were asking him, you know, why did they translate the old games into their interviewer said old English, and I clucked my tongue and I paid my student loan bill. And I said, it's early modern English. But they basically asked, you know, why did the older games have that antiquated translation? And Hori said, oh, because we didn't have any input on them. Mm-hmm. So obviously he did not like that. That was not the flavor of Dragon Quest that was intended. The old games, when they were localized, they were very dry. They were super dry. Now when you play the games and you understand what they're supposed to be like, you're like, wow, they got the tone so, so wrong. Like, thou art the great hero. When it's really just a fun, goofy anime world of, like, silly monsters and poop and boobs.
And constant puns.
Yeah, exactly. But I want to look at the previous Dragon Quest. Oh, did I say world of poop and boobs?
Yeah.
Okay. It's all true, people. But previous Dragon Quest really, I feel, in a positive way, they were chasing trends. In that, so Dragon Quest IX, I love this game. I've said it before. I'll say it again. Make an HD remake of this. Put it on something else. It's so much fun. They were chasing the Monster Hunter bandwagon to the point where level 5 basically made what would become Fantasy Life in a way. They're like, it's going to be an action game now. People did not like that. So they had a nice – I think they struck a nice balance between making it a co-op game and sticking to Dragon Quest turn-based stuff by, you know, having drop-in, drop-out co-op play, sharing dungeons, just a lot of fun little features like that. But they were really going after the huge like Monster Hunter trend where people were all playing together in the same space.
I think it's very important for Hori for his game to be number one. He doesn't like – I bet he probably didn't like Monster Hunter becoming the number one game in Japan over Dragon Quest for, mm-hmm. for about 5 years there.
And so Dragon Quest X, which we never got here – it was really chasing the MMO trend and the Wii trend. So like two trends at once. I think it struck both of them a little too late. Maybe development took a little too long. But mm-hmm. by the time it came out in 2012, I mean, things like World of Warcraft were still making a lot of money, but they weren't making like 2008 money. And the same can be said about the Wii. The Wii was like – in 2012, the Wii, who gives a shit? The Wii mm-hmm. is – it barely was surviving. But
and they seem to think that being on the Wii U would be there. Well, like we'll be early on the Wii U, so that'll pay off.
Now Dragon Quest X is on everything. It's on 3DS.
Yeah, it's on mobile ports. Yeah. It's on 3DS. It's on Steam. It's going to be on Switch. So there's ample opportunity for them to localize it, but they have not.
I mean, that's a big localization ask.
Oh,
and
sure,
also, like,
sure.
the server, too,
yeah.
I think the server needs is probably not worth it to them, I would think. Unless Nintendo subsidized it for them, perhaps. That's the only way we get anything nice is if Nintendo subsidizes it.
And that was the first internally developed Square Enix Dragon Quest game, Dragon Quest X. But, mm-hmm. yeah, I feel like they had a good intent, but they struck a little too late. I assume they made a ton of money regardless. But I think the one thing they had going for them was this game released in the wake of Final Fantasy XIV, initially just being a terrible, dismal disaster that everybody hated before it was relaunched into a very, very good game. So I feel like they had that going for them at least. Just, you know, people wanted to play an online version of a big Japanese RPG, and this was the good one, not like Final Fantasy XIV.
And I look back on it as them doing practice, like in the Unreal Engine, and practice as an internal studio development. Like it's crazy to think of a massive MMO as a practice game, but it got them ready for a true Dragon Quest. Final Fantasy way. I hate that a numbered one was the MMO. Like I do not like that.
Some MMOs are good, but based on what I've heard about this game, like on podcasts like 8-4, people that actually can, you know, read Japanese and play Japanese games, it was a very fun and good game.
I've heard that too.
But I don't think we'll ever play it. I feel like nothing ages worse than an MMO, and releasing a 2012 MMO in like 2019 or 2020, it's not good. Not going to work out for anybody involved. But so now we're at Dragon Quest XI, and I feel like this is the first Dragon Quest in a long time that is not chasing any trends. It really feels like a throwback to something like Dragon Quest VIII. It feels like a sequel to Dragon Quest VIII, in my opinion, where it's like it's doing all the modern stuff VIII did, but mm-hmm. even more in an even more modern context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like this is the first true sequel to Dragon Quest VIII.
Mm, yeah, okay. I'm glad I'm not crazy then.
No, absolutely.
I think it's not a coincidence that your pre-order unlockable costume at the start of the game is the costume of the guy from VIII.
That is true, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so like I think of 8 as a very modern game still, but it is 15 years old almost. And when I think of everything that 8 did, a lot of it is very dated and not great in a modern context. But this really just brings everything up to where it should be for the most part. Like it is super modern game that does things that previous Dragon Quest games would never do.
Never, ever do. I love how modern it feels while still also being undeniably a Dragon Quest game. Like that is – it used to be I would tell people if they were to start with a Dragon Quest, I'd tell them 5. I'd still say if you want to only give 40 hours of your life to something, then start with 5. But I would now say 11 is the one you should start with mm-hmm. because it's just so modern and accessible. Though then again, you might then hate every old Dragon Quest because of the things that aren't there anymore.
One of the things I checked just to see how modern it was, it's like, can I teleport while I'm inside? Oh, I can. Wow. It felt... I'll be honest, it felt kind of wrong that I didn't bump my head on the ceiling.
And you bumped your head on the ceiling. Like, maybe, honestly, there would be technical problems. Like, to animate and bumping their head, it looks weird. Like,
also, you can open a treasure chest from any side. It's like little things like that sound just like, yeah, of course you should be able to do that. But that was not the case in previous Dragon Quest games.
Right.
Like, you can't open the chest from this side. You can't read the sign.
You know,
from
in
this
a lot
side.
Of a lot of the games, they kept the need to use a menu to climb stairs in the Japanese version. Mm. But they were like, well, they want that in Japan, but Americans are going to hate it, so let's just streamline it. I think that was an 8.
Yeah, and there's a run button like in the American version.
Yeah, that sprint. That's why I never rode a horse. Like I rode a horse twice in that game because like the sprint is good enough. I don't need this.
Yeah, the horse. Yeah, and you can ride a horse, which is another modern thing. I feel like they're like, oh, you know, Link does that. Why can't we do that? So. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of ways to speed up travel around the world. And one thing I want to point out is that there is a 3DS version of this game that I think we just kind of forgotten about. It was unreleased in America.
I am jealous.
It does seem pretty cool, and I think this is the first time I've ever seen this idea executed. Maybe you guys can help me out if there's another attempt at this sort of a thing where it's like, yeah, I've seen games where it's like, here's the worst Wii version at the same time, or games where it's like, well, here's the PC version, here's the PS3 version, things like that. But this is the identical version. Mostly like 99.7% identical version on two very, very different platforms. I don't know if that's been done before.
That identical, it's hard to think. Closest examples I can think of is, say, with Spider-Man games, they would make the current gen version of a Spider-Man game like Ultimate Spider-Man and Web of Shadows. And then there would be a game called that on a DS or a GBA. But it would be a completely different game. It would not be the same. So there were lesser ports, but
right.
– or maybe like the PSP version of Spider-Man 2 that was just a linear non-open world game. Hmm. Sorry, all my examples are Spider-Man.
Any non-Spider-Man examples? But I'm sure there are some edge cases, and please let me know in the comments. But I feel like this was a very, very interesting idea and one that we will never get to experience if you don't read Japanese because it is only in Japanese.
When I was playing that game – and thinking about how could this be done in 2D, a couple of this, like especially around Galapagos, like that area, like this is so tiered and leveled. How would this work in it? I'm really interested to see. I kind of want to just pull up a long play of somebody playing the 3DS Japanese version in just Super NES, Super Famicom mode, basically.
I watch a lot of videos, and I feel like there aren't too many differences. There are a few very minor ones that make sense given the technology where there is like in the 3DS version, that whole, finding targets on the overworld map is not a thing. Like that's not a thing you do in the game at all. And there's one major difference in that there is more content in the 3DS version. There's like a secret special area that is a throwback to all of the older Dragon Quest games that has like four super bosses, a bunch of bonus content and things like that. That's not in the PS4 version. But in the PS4 version, you do get slime slots.
Slots are fun, but I'm more of a poker player anyway, though.
And also that target shooting game. So
I don't like that.
No, I don't like it either. No, but slime slots is like – I just set that up and like walk away. Like, oh, go win for me, slime slots. I'll be back in half an hour.
But the poker game, man, I played that until I had one liquid metal slime helm and two metal slime swords.
You told me like one day you just spent all day playing Dragon Quest Poker.
Pretty much, yeah. My husband came in. He's like, weren't you supposed to beat that dungeon? I was like, but the poker. And so you just boop, boop, boop.
So thank you, Dragon Quest, for teaching us all how to gamble.
Yeah, I've heard rumors that the Switch version of Dragon Quest 11 will include both the 3D version and the 2D version in some capacity. I don't know if that's true, but that would be pretty great if you could like switch between viewpoints or something.
Yeah, so you brought that up, Jeremy. We didn't mention this. So the 3DS version has like a lesser graphics in terms of the 3D graphics. Mm. But for some reason in that version of the game, you see all your party members on the map at the same time. But that's not true of the PS4 version, which is odd. Mm. But yeah, it looks like a 3DS game with, reduced character models, like little like their chibi
and
models.
Very like chunky, not chunky, but very thick cell shading.
It's a really good looking 3DS game. Mm-hmm. I mean, even compared to the PS4 game, but
it's a beautiful PS4 and PC game, so it just doesn't compare.
You really can't compare them. But there's also 2D mode, which essentially turns the game into a Super Famicom game. So it's interesting to see that the same basic game experience can happen between the PS4 level visuals, the 3DS level visuals, and then this faking of a 16-bit RPG.
As a celebration of the 30th anniversary of Dragon Quest.
32nd.
they announced it for the 30th. Like, the 30th anniversary can last as long as they wanted to. But yeah.
It's the years of Luigi.
As a celebration of that having those different ways of playing the game make it exist in basically almost every era of Dragon Quest as well. Mm-hmm. I hope the Switch version does have that, since it was on the other Nintendo system. That makes it seem more likely. I think I'm just sad about the Switch. I hope that could have a worldwide release date the same. But so far, they've only announced it for Japan. I mean, you can assume it's coming eventually, but probably after Japan, I would think.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully not in 2020, maybe next year as of this recording date. Yeah. But yeah, I just kind of want to jump around. I mean, we've all played a lot of this game, and I have some topics I want to talk about just in terms of what the game does compared to older games, if we like it or not. And we can just jump around in here. I do want to talk about basic mechanics and things like that, like the party, like how the party system works. And I feel like we said earlier, it is a throwback to 8 and earlier games. You don't create characters. They're all predefined, so that's very different than 9 and 10. And this time there are more than 4 in a party that has 4 slots, so you have to basically decide upon what your character lineup is. In 8, there were just 4 characters. In the 3DS version of 8, they add 2 more, so it's more like this, where you have to decide who to swap out.
And you can swap kind of on the fly during battles, too.
Yeah.
Like, you can change your lineup pretty liberally for a Dragon Quest game. Which
reminds
really
me of Final Fantasy X.
Yeah. It was something I, like, strategy-wise, wasn't used to that, so I didn't think you could. Even if the game told me, I probably just skimmed over, like, well, you can't do that in a Dragon Quest game, so I won't expect it. Once I learned at, like, hour 75, I'm like, this radically changes how I do these fights now. And, I mean, the party, I miss it. I think I love Dragon Quest job system, but this is one of the other year type things where they're not going to do a job system because 9 was all about jobs. But so instead you have a party that each is a job, and I really like just about everybody in the party pretty much, I think.
Yeah, except Rob.
Rab.
But he likes dirty books. I mean,
okay. Well, that's great. Dirty old man jokes. It's funny.
Yes.
He seems really redundant, and I think it's telling that once you kind of go to the big plot event where everything changes and you have to reform your party, he's one of the very first characters you get because he's so redundant with the sisters.
Yeah.
I just never used him until the game forced me to. And then I was like, oh, I guess he's okay. But
His role was never super clear to me just because I had 2 characters like him before.
Oh, right. And then after that skip, you end up with 1 character who's like does everything that he does and more. So then he goes out of your party again.
He doesn't heal as well, though, that guy. Rob's a better healer.
I guess. But you can get by. Like, other characters have the ability to heal. You've got healing items. Come on.
Yeah, a ton of characters can heal in this game. That's true.
I like Rab. I didn't play him a ton until the middle of the game. Until the game's second act, let's say. No spoilers on this podcast, but until the game's second act. But then they kind of give him a real boost. They give him really good ability for story points. And I also kind of liked hearing more about him being spanked a lot in the past was a funny character moment. I was like, oh, I like you more now.
I think it was very formative
like
for him.
I missed that part.
Oh. That was a big thing in one of the towns.
Yes.
You learn about his upbringing, and maybe that's why he's such a perv.
Oh, yeah. Well, so he was trained by the woman who runs Angrala, which is the training ground, and they talk about how if you mess up, you get paddled.
Oh,
and they say
okay.
that he got paddled more than anybody else ever.
Right.
And you're like, oh, does that mean he screwed up? But then as you think about it more, it's like, no, he intentionally did badly, so this woman would spank him.
He was into it.
He was just a skinny lad, didn't know no good from bad.
That's the party. And in terms of building characters and stuff like that, it's just like 8, but much, much better. In 8, it was like, here's skill points. Here are some categories. Figure it out. We don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen, so you can easily make mistakes. Here, it's like, here is a fun skill chart. And you know what the things you're unlocking are. You don't know what some of them are, but it's going to be a cool surprise. And also, if you mess up or if you want to specialize in a different weapon, you can just pay a little bit of money and then they will just take all those away. They will take all the spend points away, give them back to you, and you can spend them again. So, yeah, you specialize between different weapon types and I guess each character has a sort of like pep specialization or whatever they call it, or just a sort of like character specialization.
When you can unlock other peps, you can unlock co-op peps more just randomly based on what skills you do. I love the skill tree. I could not get enough of it and re-rolling, and also how through story points and character moments, the skill trees would change too, which also then kind of forced you to use different things or start trying out different things. So
yeah,
I never touched boomerangs because always I think boomerangs and whips suck. I'm not into them in Dragon Quest. Sorry, I'm a hater.
No, you're right. Like certain story events, I'll be like, oh, I can't do that anymore. That's why I got all these points back. That's really cool. Yeah, I like how that affects the way your party is made up and how you develop your party. But yeah, I really like – I mean they could not have done it like 8 because it would just – no one would have liked it. But I do like how it's like that's what I want to go for. That last skill there, that's something I want. So you can definitely see like here's everything this weapon can do with a few surprises along the way.
Well, the other character – well, can we talk about Silvando now? Can we
talk? Absolutely.
Yeah, why not? I forgot his name.
How dare you.
I think that is Homer
Darling,
in the Japanese
how
version.
Can you forget?
Oh, wait. No, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of other dude. Never mind. Please. Yeah.
No, Silvando. I love Silvando because he's the fun jester character, which those were the goofballs. You were either the girl in a Playboy bunny outfit or the goofball jester.
A giant clown.
Yes. Which is your pathway to being a sage in other Dragon Quest games. Not in this one. But that Silvando, I was so worried when he first appeared in this game because a lot of anime has a bad history of homophobic jokes. And even that last year in a game I very much loved, Persona 5, it had some very homophobic characters in it.
And he's so effeminate and seems so stereotypical at first that, I just kind of braced myself. I was like, this is going to be bad. This is going places.
Which,
all right.
I'm curious if anything changed in the localization.
That was my question. Yeah. I don't want to assume worse of the Japanese writers. I'm not sure how much of that was softened or improved in localization or in terms of Persona, if it was just like, no, don't change this. This has to be done directly.
But in the Silvando I played in the North American release, I really love him. He is just so positive, so supportive. He's just like, oh, honey, we'll figure this out. Hey, is that right, Princey Poo? Like, he's very effeminate but fun, and nobody ever makes fun of him. There's no joke where, like, easily they could have done a scene where Eric's like, ugh, I don't want to room with that guy whatever.
His feminine qualities don't make him weak or a joke or anything like that.
And nobody dislikes him for
I mean, everyone thinks he's like the amazing Silvando. He's like revered for his combat skills.
He makes everyone happy too. Yeah, and that he is one of the great – like one of the coolest things I like is in his background, you find out in his knight training that he was a better knight than Hendrick in training and beat Hendrick. So – they're saying, like, as a knight, the most powerful one in the world of his generation was the super effeminate dorko who wanted to join the circus and make the world happy.
Good hair, too, and eyelashes.
Yeah,
they do – like, the quest line specifically centered around him in the second act of the game, which involves a lot of people prancing in carnival outfits, a lot of men prancing in carnival outfits. I was like, whoa, this is not what I want to see in a video game, but it didn't go wrong.
No, it was just fun. Nobody made fun of the guys who were very feminine. When they're dancing around the town, the other town folks
Everyone's
are
like I want to dance
fun.
Too.
Yeah. Wow, these guys have got good moves.
We've come a long way since the Honeybee Inn.
And it ultimately culminates in what I feel is like a metaphor for acceptance and coming to terms with someone following a life path or, you know, like expressing themselves in a way that the parents didn't necessarily expect. But it has a great resolution. And like at every step, the Silvando plot lines and just the character really surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, honestly, coming from this series, I really didn't expect that.
Me too.
I didn't expect him to be explicitly gay or to have a boyfriend or anything, though that's also like – it's very rare anyone has a relationship in a Dragon Quest game. They definitely like – they are very much stuck in the 80s of their love of cheeky girls in bunny costumes.
Yeah, the only love is just like breasts being pushed in your face off screen. That's basically all it amounts to.
That is the true love.
Yeah, but that does culminate in the amazing puff puff joke in the mines. So to me, that all kind of pays off.
I like that one a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of good puff puff callbacks too. There's at least two classic puff puff scenes in it. Yeah. which I'm glad they fully embraced Puff Puff. And like sometimes they had to – I think Nintendo was a little more restrictive on Puff Puff jokes
than
they are.
It will be a powder puff massage, sir.
These days Nintendo is the least restrictive on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's true.
All their games are so horny now.
Yeah. Well, that's because Sony's like, no horniness.
We'll have all the horniness. And
there'll
be more.
Every PS4 Pro comes with saltpeter.
And there will be more horniness to come after the break.
If you like my show, you're going to love Rob Has a Podcast on Podcast One. Join the biggest reality TV podcast around as Survivor's Rob Cisternino covers the current season of Celebrity Big Brother and more. Download Rob Has a Podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of... Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolate.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile's super reliable, super fast nationwide network and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
Hello, we are back, and we're going to be talking about more Dragon Quest XI stuff, and we have not really covered the battle system yet. And it works roughly the same as it did in past games, though there's a very big difference that you might not notice unless you're paying attention, in that you in previous games, you would choose all the characters' actions, and then they would do their actions based on a number of different factors. Now their turns just come up organically. Of course, they're based on certain factors, but now their turns just come up, and you decide what they do, and then they do it. And I like that a lot because it actually makes the game a little bit easier, because sometimes you, if you're with your healer, like, oh boy, I should probably heal now because there could be a big attack from this enemy, but I won't really know until the enemy acts. But now you can sort of react on the fly. And I think it's it feels a lot better. It does feel very more modern, but it's something I didn't really notice until I thought about it, because usually every RPG works like that. Dragon Quest was the one that just sort of fell behind in terms of like the way turns worked.
Etrian Odyssey still does the act as a team thing. It's still out there, but
right.
that series is very deliberately retro-facing, so it's meant to be dated, whereas mm-hmm. Dragon Quest I don't think is so much, so it's good that it updated.
I kind of like the challenge of planning when you picked as a group, because you're like, boy, I hope this character isn't dead when I'm doing heal. I'm picking heal on them, or I hope this enemy is still alive when I do attack, because otherwise I'm just going to miss. Your character will be too stupid to know to attack somebody who's alive. They'll be like, no, I decided to attack the person who's dead now. Whoops.
Yeah, I mean,
they did cut that out pretty early, didn't they?
Sort of.
I feel like they would just shift your attack to something else, but it would not be ideal.
Right. But that's not my complaint with the act as a group system. It's more like, it was kind of hard to know exactly when a character would act. So if you were trying to plan consecutive actions with your team, you couldn't be sure that they would fire off in the order you needed them to. Mm-hmm. So that was frustrating. Like, I feel with Etrian Odyssey, there is a very clear like action hierarchy, like speed, statistic. So you can know like this character is always going to act third unless I use this ability that causes them to act first in the turn, in which case they'll go first, and then that'll shift everyone's order. But Dragon Quest didn't really have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was kind of a crapshoot as to whether or not a character would act first. You could easily goose it by like putting, you know, different equipment on them to increase their speed, but it often wouldn't work the way you wanted it to. But yeah, I think it, on the downside, it does make the game a lot easier. I feel like this is the easiest Dragon Quest game I've ever played. Not like a cakewalk, but I feel like there are no real surprises in battle.
Yeah, I didn't turn on any of the difficulty features.
Draconian Quest, yeah.
Which is nice. Like, you can tune it to be as difficult as you want. I didn't turn any of those on, and... Either. Well, I didn't fight the final boss because I needed to do some serious leveling up before the taking that on. I did pretty much everything else in the game, and I only saw a game over once.
Okay.
And that was to a battle that I just absolutely did not expect. It's like a boss fight that you take on, and you're like, whoa, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah, I think I know the one you're talking about.
It's in a very cold place.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
That was my one loss because my party was walking around ragged. Having gotten beaten up in a few battles, and I was like, oh, I'm okay. I can survive a few more fights like this. I don't need to heal up. And then that guy showed up, and I was like, well, I'm dead.
I had one big mistake with that on the difficulty thing, which was, speaking of ease, like, you can restart from three places. You can restart from an autosave. You can restart old style of the nearest town you were in and lose half your stuff. Or you can restart from a hard save. And I was in a Golden Palace dungeon and I died in it after I had gone through – I was like, well, I'm not going to die here. And this final boss can't be that hard. I get murdered by it. And so then I think I bet it auto-saved right before I went into this boss room. It did not. So when I went back to my autosave, it was when I entered the dungeon, I lost every single thing I had in there, which was a lot of stuff because I took forever to go to every item in that dungeon, which there are a lot of them in that one especially. I really regretted that.
So another thing you can do in the game, in the battles rather, and I like that it's there even though it's pointless, you can run around. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of stopped doing it after the first, I don't know, 5 hours. But it's just like, you're not doing anything. Just run around. It's fine. Like, where you are doesn't matter. It's just something for your hands to do while turns are playing out. And you can actually – then you can see, monsters from different angles. Just, make the battles more dynamic visually by having characters run around that you're controlling. And it is pretty cool.
Did either of you guys go to the camera setting that was, traditional?
I just did that right away.
Oh, yeah. No, I stuck with the newer camera angle behind each person the whole game. I really like – well, the free camera, but begins stationed behind the person.
What is the traditional camera like?
Oh, it goes like 8.
You don't Dragon Quest 8.
Okay.
Yeah. You'll see the camera faces the person who's going to attack, and then they make their attack, and then you see it hit the enemy.
I felt that was just snappier and less trouble, so I just went with that.
I think it looks really good, even though because of how the enemies were designed, some of them, they were designed as 2D enemies first. They're not always designed to be viewed from other angles.
That's what I love.
Yeah, but I like how they make them all work. They somehow make them all work.
I love the goofy goobers who just look so strange.
But slugs. Their slugs always have their heads turned towards you, so when you walk around them, it's just like, wow, that's a weird design.
Or the kind of oafish boar men who have the the club over their
they're
shoulder.
Posed looking at you. Yes,
Cyclops.
The Cyclops, he's – or just always in mid-stomp pose. That's what I really like, too.
And the enemy models, this game is – okay, we've said it before. This is a really good-looking game, and I just assumed, I played Builders. I played Heroes. They're just going to dump all of those models into this game. No, that's not true at all. They are, new models with, better textures. They easily could have taken shortcuts. They have all those resources. They made those games. But they made new models. They tweaked the models. Amazing looking stuff in this game, for sure.
They all look so good. The fight, the action animations always look great too. Not just the attacks, but also when you defeat an enemy, Hori makes a point in interviews of you don't kill them, you defeat them. You're not killing people. We're not that mean. But when you defeat them, sometimes if you do it with a big strike, they fall backwards. They have a cool animation of dropping their item or whatever.
Yeah.
And then other times if you were to zap them with fire or whatever, they then collapse forward. It's not repeated. They vary that too, which is really cool.
Yeah, I really love the battle system in this game because it is very much a super old school traditional RPG battle system, but I really feel like they maximize what you can do with that. There are so many little variations to things, like you said, not just the animations, which are great, but just the way battles can flow. I mean, in a lot of RPGs, it's just like you fight the same formations over and over again. I feel like in this game, I mean, you do see some of the same formations multiple times, but within each area, like, they tend to shift around, like, mix up the mix of enemies that you face. And if I'm not mistaken, like, the enemies that you see in the field can sometimes combine and you'll, like, yeah, end up with multiple battles, you know, like, multiple battle groups. And also, there are a lot of enemies who can change the dynamic of the battle by summoning reinforcements or by combining or doing some weird things that actually change up the dynamic of a battle kind of on the fly. And so what I found is that even though you're fighting like the same mix of, I don't know, five or six different monsters in a dungeon, those encounters always feel different and always feel kind of vital, even though it's just like it could be just, you know, a turn-based battle slog against the same enemies over and over again. But that never happens, or at least it didn't in my experience. Mm-hmm. And I played for 80-plus hours. Mm-hmm. I just feel like they did a really great job of thinking, how can we make little tweaks and little changes and just do little things that are going to keep players on their toes and keep the battle systems, you know, constantly churning and constantly changing. It also helps that, you know, as we've mentioned before, the party makeup changes a lot over the course of the game. And the abilities that characters have sometimes changes. Like, there are some pretty dramatic changes to who you can use at different mm-hmm. times. And even, like, the nature of how a character approaches battle.
Yeah.
And so you can't just rely on, like, the same group. You can switch to a group for, like, you know, 10 hours. But then something's going to happen and you're going to be like, well, I can't just use the same comfortable strategies and tactics that I've been using. I have to rethink how I approach battle. Mm-hmm. So they just I really feel like they've taken the sort of platonic concept, you know, just like the cliche JRPG combat turn-based battle system and said, let's wring every possible bit of value out of this. And it's just a great, great battle system.
And if you get new skills from a level up, then I'll want to use them differently. Like it when with I wasn't using Eric as much, and then I unlocked his dual blade ability, a dual wield ability, and so he then moved to one of my regulars or same, and then he kind of fell back, and then I learned to steal with him. I was like, well, I got to have him and more stuff too. And I think too, having the monsters on the field map made random battle, well, not random, but made battles so much more fun for me. I was choosing to start them because oftentimes I was like, I haven't fought that enemy in this area yet.
Yeah.
I want to try it and maybe I'll even get a good drop. Like that, it inspired me more than just taking 10 steps and having a battle start.
And then going, oh, come on. Yes, I just want to get to the town.
Yeah, and I love the way the game uses the sort of character models on the field to kind of give you the ability to say, well, I'm going to customize my experience. Like, I don't think I can fight this guy. He looks really intimidating. Or, you know, fairly early on, you go into a forest area and there's like kind of layers of the forest and you can see paths down below that you're not going to be able to get to for like 20 hours. And you can see some like kind of high level monsters down there and you're not going to fight them. But at the same time, it serves as a reminder like, you know, there are some things out there that I'm going to have to get really strong to face. There's some scary stuff in this world. And so it kind of gives you this little taste of what's ahead. So mm-hmm. yeah, it just, yeah, I really can't say enough good things about how the combat system has been integrated into Dragon Quest XI.
We'll be right back.
One thing that we mentioned earlier but didn't really define or talk about too much is the PEP system.
I love PEP.
It's way better. So it sort of reminds me of the tension building in Dragon Quest VIII, but it's a much better version of that. So in VIII, you had I believe the command was psych up. An 8, and you basically, there were four levels of it. Ideally, you want to reach the last one and go Super Saiyan and have really strong attacks. But to do that, every time you would do the psych up command, you would use a turn, and then enemies would have this skill that would like wipe your psych out. Like every boss had that skill, so just like it was like a real crapshoot. It's like, how long can I actually get to the maximum tension? How long will it let me stay at maximum tension? In this game, you will drop into PEP mode based on certain factors I'm not completely aware of, but it happens.
Damage is one of them.
It's okay. I figured it was damage you take, like like limit breaks in Final Fantasy VII, something like that. But you don't see a meter or anything like that, as far as I know. But basically, what happens when you're in PEP mode is you are stronger and you take less damage, and also you can do powerful PEP attacks either by yourself or with other characters, and they really remind me of Chrono Trigger. This game totally, even though it can be a hard state to get into and it goes away pretty fast, so you're going to end up, unless you focus on getting into PEP mode a lot skill wise, there are certain like passive abilities that make you drop into PEP mode more often, you're going to miss a lot of these combo attacks. But there are some that use three and even four characters.
There's quad slash fucking rules, and I did it three times in the entire game, because to have four people and one of them is the lead character pepped at the same time is almost impossible, just timing wise.
Yeah,
and but when you can do it, you do like over 2,000 damage.
A pro tip for our friends at home: if you're trying to do the quests that are like do this pep attack or do this combo attack, what I do is like I get the one character pepped up, and then I rotate them out of my party and I save, and then I get the other character pepped up, and then I put the other character back in my party, and then I do the attack. Like you have to really plan things out ahead of time if you want to get those quests done. They can be tricky quests. If you're just waiting for it to happen naturally, it will take a long time to sort of have that sync up in the way you want to.
So clever,
yeah. You have to cheat the system. So that is my PEP strategy for you. But yeah, it's really cool. I wish it was more evident as to when it would happen. But I guess it's more of a fun surprise
happen. My favorite character to see pepped would be Veronica, because she's just so tiny. And so when she would go Super Saiyan and just go, it was just so funny.
And all of the animations, I mean, they're sort of like Final Fantasy summons in a way. They're just I mean, you can skip them, but they're very flashy, cool animations. Your other characters doing really cool attacks and firing lasers and fireballs and dancing and things like that. Just a very fun, flashy thing that does a lot of damage. But again, you can skip those. So I want to talk about the overworld a bit. It is a big change, and in some ways it's very much like 8. So one thing I really like, okay, so there are no random battles, and you can easily run from one corner of the map to the other and avoid all the enemies. It's not hard to just explore the map. And like in 8, it's not a seamless world, but it is to scale. So, you know, you walk when you leave the world, you're not like running into a town icon the size of your character. You can see like the gates of the town and things like that. But one thing I really hope for 12 is that they might have been restricted by wanting to make this sort of on par with the 3DS version, but I really would love to see this as like a Final Fantasy 15 style open world game where it's like I go to the town and there's no loading screen. I just walk into the town and I'm there. We have the technology, people.
But then you wouldn't get your gameplay tips.
That is
how
true.
Are you going to learn how to play the game if you don't have loading screens, damn it?
They need to remind me what the run button is every 8 hours. But I feel like that is the one thing I really would love to see them change. It's the one thing that makes it feel like a little too old-fashioned, that like tied to older technology. I just kind of want to I don't want to go as far as like I'm going to get in my car and drive around Dragon Quest World, but I still want to just – oh, there's a town. I'll walk into the town. I'm in the town and I'm doing stuff in the town.
Yeah, I would like not having battle transitions too, because this game – pretty much gives you battles where they take place. If you look
almost
at the world
exactly,
map and when you're fighting, it's like a slightly simplified model of the exact location you're at. And I wonder if that's a technical limitation, if there really is a technical limitation there, or if it was just like there's always battle transitions in Dragon Quest, so we got to keep the battle transitions. Yeah. We don't want to change things too much.
I guess at least there aren't load times or anything like that for battles.
Yeah, yeah. It goes really quickly. It's very seamless.
There are some long load times in the game, especially when you're loading a town or whatever.
I do really like that aspect of going from overworld to battles, especially like in dungeons. I recall one dungeon where I got in a fight and I was like, but I wanted to look over at what was over there. And then I turned the camera and was like, oh, there it is over there. There's a treasure chest. Cool. I'm going to go over there. It helped me plan out how I was going to explore things thanks to that easy transition. I kind of did like the – I liked that it loaded between worlds or – well, I didn't like loading. But I I liked that there was a clear wall between Outer World and cities only because there was a really good point that Super Eyepatch Wolf made in his video about how much he did not like Final Fantasy 15, which I agree with. I like 15 a lot. But one of the things he didn't like was that he felt it lacked realism, that you lived in this world where there are giant monsters everywhere, but nobody had walled off cities or anything. They're just like, nah. And meanwhile, Dragon Quest XI does look like they built a city that they're like, well, we got to keep these monsters out of here.
So there's like always
there's
a big
Cyclops
gate
out there and his whole family, and I don't want them to kill us.
Exactly. Meanwhile, Final Fantasy 15, they're like,
there's a gas station.
We'll just build this gas station. I know Bahamut's over there, but we'll be fine. This chain link fence will protect us.
They're used to it. Other things on this map that are new for Dragon Quest game are they have resource points, sort of like Monster Hunter.
I love those.
Very, very modern thing to do in a video game. Maybe some people don't like them, but it's just a fun way to get resources, a really easy way to get resources.
That was in Dragon Quest IX also.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, you had
I couldn't remember.
You had the whole alchemy system in Dragon Quest IX, and oh god, so much of my game was just spent running around gathering resources. Like I would just travel through the world, and then you know by the time I got to the other end of the world, everything would have respawned, so I'd make another pass through it.
So there were resource points.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't
remember.
There
were lots of in the like little sparkling points that you could run over and you'd get stuff, and then you could forge stuff in the alchemy lab.
Okay. Yeah, Monster Hunter didn't invent those, but I feel like they were definitely copying that in a fun way.
Yeah, Dragon Quest IX, as you said, was like, let's be Monster Hunter. So that is where that came from. But I'm glad they carried it through because that and the alchemy system here feel like refined versions of what you had in Dragon Quest IX. Mm-hmm. The alchemy system I love in this game. It was super addictive in 9.
We will talk about that.
Okay.
I have one more thing to go over with the map.
My apologies.
It's okay because crafting is next on my list. So the one thing I don't like about the map, so in Dragon Quest VIII, it's a very big world and the map is terrible. It's a bad 2D map. It's easy to get lost and you're always, at least in the non-3DS version, you're always running into random battles. In the PS2 version, you're doing that. In this game, what I don't like is as soon as you get to an area, it's like, oh, here's the entire map. Oh, here's everything on the map. Like, I feel like there is not a huge incentive to explore in this game. I'm just sort of like using the map that I already have in front of me. I'm not like, what's around this corner? I'm like, I know what's around this corner. It's on my map.
Well, yes, but when I see those maps, I also miss the real sense of discovery, though. On some dungeons, they do like gray out areas.
I want just
– well, and you don't see the location of like – gathering points or treasures.
If you
that's
see something's
true.
A dead end, then that makes me want to go there sooner because I'm like, well, then that's where the treasure is.
That is true. Actually, you have to unlock the locations of those things on your map by finding them. But I kind of just wanted – and this is not like a very Dragon Quest-y thing. I just kind of wanted the map to gradually unlock as I explored, you know, just to have it like draw in the map, which is a thing a lot of games do. And I feel like there would have been more surprises. But yeah, there is some stuff to be found on the map. On your own. And one of the things you can also do in the game is certain monsters you can ride on them. And that is one of the ways where you can explore because there are certain areas you can only get to when you're on the back of a giant bee, perhaps. Or,
or a flying dragon.
Yeah.
That's only in like 3 caves in the entire game. But I think too, speaking of the world map, one thing that it's just because the last one I played before this was 7. But that has such a monstrously huge world map that this one feels small by comparison, even though it's not – I would not call it actually a small world map, but it just feels smaller than 7. So
I think each area is very well defined.
Oh,
7 is
so
just
much,
like a
yeah.
just huge landmass,
yes.
Like with not a lot of interesting features. So we talked about crafting earlier. I want to bring it up again because, yeah, it's a big part of this game. I feel like every game since 8 has gotten just even better at this. Jeremy, we all played 9 a lot, but I think you reviewed it, right?
I did.
In 9, was there an alchemy pot where you waited for things, or
no,
was it instant?
Eight was where you waited.
Yeah.
9 was where you just did stuff. But the thing about 9 is it had like this extremely complex tier system where you would have to create an item and then you would use that item and another item that you created to create a third item, and you would use that with another item that you created to create a fourth item. And so there was a whole lot of like gathering up very like basic level resources and putting them together to create like a higher tier thing. And then those would, you know, be applied toward things. So it was like this ladder that you had to climb. And it was very addictive, but at the same time, I'm glad 11 sort of stepped away from that and simplified things a whole lot.
Yeah.
Because it was much more satisfying to make the challenge more about the execution as opposed to the go out in the world and find, you know, 20 clumps of manure. It's much more streamlined, but still at the same time, like there is this sort of volatility to it, and you're rewarded for performing well, and you have a lot of limitations, so you have to kind of be mindful of how you approach it. It's a very thoughtful and strategic kind of crafting system, and I think it's really effective.
Yeah, the crafting in 9 was very much like old Monster Hunter. It was very baroque. There were like way too many items. Even Monster Hunter did a much better job of fixing that in World. But I do like how if you want to find the ingredients, they're not impossible to find, and you don't need to go through those different tiers of refining things to make new ingredients for the most part. And the way crafting works, it's a little mini game system, and basically you're given a certain amount of points to spend, and you're given the shape of the item, and you basically have to think, how do I spend these points in the most effective way to fill all these little bars in this little diagram of the item. And it's very fun, and they don't punish you too much for screwing up. You can spend a few of these pretty negligible items to redo your item.
I love those perfectionist pearls. Yeah, this is some of my favorite crafting I think I've ever had in a game. I liked how simple it was. The only time they started actually introducing the stuff Jeremy was just talking about of craft with an item that you've already crafted is so late in the game. Like, those are some of the last recipes I got. Mm-hmm. And it also just made, you know, the finding recipe system made another cool thing to search the map for and check every single freaking item for, because like, have I smashed every pot in this town?
Yeah.
No, this one's still got a recipe in it. Or, ooh, there's a red book I haven't pulled off the shelf. Like,
I did the same thing in every town. I wouldn't talk to anyone first. I would go into every house, smash every pot, check every bookshelf, every barrel. And then it's like, I would do my rounds then. It's like, now I can talk to everybody. Like, I wanted to get that out of the way first.
First we loot, then we socialize.
Hey, they're fine with it.
And I like the leveling system to it too, because, you know, the game, the crafting would get easier as you level up because you get new skills and more action points, but it never became super easy if you wanted to still keep crafting the best items.
Yeah, and the items that you would craft in terms of how you would actually craft them in the actions you input, they would become more complicated. They would have different shapes that would be more difficult to work with, things like that. So it's a very fun little game that, again, like Jeremy said, it's more about the execution than just the legwork of finding all the things.
And as soon as I could purchase Perfectionist Pearls,
yeah,
that's when I would make sure no one walks around with anything less than a plus two, and really all plus three.
Where, like, could you buy Perfectionist Pearls?
From Les Maisons de the mini metal place, the mini metal school.
Yeah.
Buy them at the boy, you guys are missing out.
No, I did a bunch of trading there. I just didn't realize you could buy Perfectionist Pearls. I must have missed that.
I didn't run out of them yet. I assume you could buy them from that little merchant that's always at your camp.
Oh, I never talked to him. I just bought it from the mini metal place.
He sells different things every time.
Yeah, but he also sells a lot of the like basic to medium crafting things you need. So if you need like a plant or like a, I don't know, bronze or whatever, you can talk to him.
But at the mini metal school, right next to the person who sells – who you can rent a room from at the inn, they is a woman who sells Perfectionist Pearls. And so you can – they're actually pretty affordable, 100 gold for one.
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the story really quick. It's very much in the Dragon Quest tradition. It's a picaresque adventure. You solve a series of dilemmas caused by a villain you don't meet until much, much, much later in the game. I kind of like that about Dragon Quest. It's like, who's doing all this? It's like – a bunch of bad things are happening. You're solving all the problems, and they're all loosely connected to one thing. And then eventually you meet the thing, and it's a surprise. Like, oh, that's the thing? Oh, geez.
It was – that's what made it like a big moment at hour 30-ish when they said the name of the big bad out loud. I was like, oh, he has a name. Wow. Now we're getting somewhere.
Sauron? Amazing.
And as I said before, as usual, the hero is pretty boring. We talked about Silvando. It's a pretty great cast. I like this cast a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a great mix of personalities. There's all kinds of different body types, I feel, too, represented in this game.
You've got Bodacious in Jade, and you've got Portly in Rap.
Your girl, any kind of waifu you want. Hands off the smaller waifu,
yeah,
though, please.
Yeah, avoid the smaller waifu.
Well, but Bob, she's been aged down by magic. She's
stop
actually,
it.
No,
stop
I know.
It.
That makes it even worse.
No, I don't think there's anybody I don't like in the group because I say I like Rab. I mean, at first –
yeah, Rab is kind of like the dead weight for me. Sorry.
At first, Serena seems boring, but she in Act 2 gets a lot more interesting as well. Mm-hmm. And also in the cast and just all the characters in the story, this is something that really gets underrated in Dragon Quest. But there is like a – kind of multiculturalism to it too, because you go to other towns and people just start, they say something in French first.
Or they speak in haiku.
Or in haiku, and you know it's supposed to be Japan. Or you'll go
what?
To a version of Italy, you'll go to a version of Spain, you'll go to a version of the Netherlands. Like it's a very, they embrace the Euro-ness of the tropes they're borrowing from by just sending you all across the European Union, basically.
Yeah, it's. I mean, well, and then you get the sort of Asian continent areas. It's a very, like, British colonial approach to the world.
Yes, yeah.
You're all fun characters.
Well, you do have a guy with kind of an American accent in this case. Eric is, like, British trying to be American, which is...
He's got, like, a Tommy Wiseau accent.
Yeah, it's new. It's, like, something Dragon Quest hasn't done before. Where is this American place that you're from?
Well, when you find out his background, it makes sense why he just has, like, no real accent or background, too. Like, he's
a man of the world.
Yeah, he's just a vagabond. He just goes around, man, and he's... he is so much more interesting than the main character.
I call him Blue Chrono, and he is the actual main character of the game.
Well, but he disappears for a while in Act 2.
It's true, but it's like when you finally get that Dragon Quest XI title card, he's there. Mm. He's there. It's like this is the true hero of the game. Ignore this guy with good hair and no features.
And the side people you meet around the world are great too. I mean, the best is, to me, of the one-off characters is Michelle the mermaid.
Oh, yeah.
Boy. And there's Hawaii in this game, too. There's also, well, just a Polynesian island in general. Mm-hmm. And that one, Lona Lulu, and the story of Michelle is so, like, pretty and heartfelt and just very real. Like, when they did it in the game, I was like, are they going there with this? And then they went there, baby. But they did.
It's pretty surprising. But yeah, that's a great story in the game. We talked about there's an Act 2. Again, no spoilers or anything. There is a sort of twist in the game. I don't know if even telling you there's a twist is a spoiler, but I guess
too bad.
You can yell at me if you want. I don't know. But
I already spoiled it.
Okay. But I do feel my only issue with this, like it feels derivative of another Dragon Quest game, the twist in that game. And also, it also feels very derivative of another RPG, but I can't say what they are.
A very famous RPG, too,
yes.
That when it
happened. Well, shut up. Okay. We can't say anything else.
All right.
That was rude of me. I apologize. But okay. I don't want to get more death threats, what I'm saying. But yeah, I feel like, not to go too far into it, but it's cool. I like it. But I have seen it before.
Yeah, I like how you sort of come to sort of consciousness after the big plot twist, and you find
Careful.
Yourself very very out of sorts, shall we say, and you have to adjust to things being entirely new from like every perspective.
That element that I won't say what it is is a very Toriyama touch, I think. A very
I love that
whimsical
moment,
Toriyama
yes.
touch.
Yeah. Well, you need some whimsy at that point
yeah.
in the game, I think. Well, also the ending, I'm going to spoil it right now. No. but I do – so I'm used to in a Dragon Quest and other games like it where they have the ending and then the true ending. Like say in Persona 4 when they give you an ending, they make it clear enough of like, well, but you know this isn't the real ending. Come on. Keep going. Like, but in this game – when they give you the first credits roll, I am fully satisfied by that ending.
Yeah, you're like, oh, okay,
and I'm
cool.
Like, yeah, this is good. This is a good ending. Now, and it leaves you in an interesting place that I'm not used to Dragon Quest leaving me as well, like
right.
emotionally.
But at the same time, there is a lot the game leaves unresolved at that first ending.
Yeah.
So like, if you've been paying any attention at all, there's stuff you're wondering, like, what's that about? I mean, those little I will say those little ghost guys in the very intro of the game, those are not explained until
At hour 90, I was screaming like, what the fuck are these? You still haven't told me.
What are these crazy Mononokes running around?
Right. So, you know, so like those things aren't explained at all.
And you
the
see them
the
everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And they're clearly doing something. And you're like, what the hell? What is going on? So,
I mean,
like if you care at all about this world, like you will continue to keep playing because you're just like, I got to know what's up with, you know, the Kodoma over there or whatever.
I felt the true ending was almost too fan servicey compared to the other ending.
I guess that's who it's for, though, if you're willing to sink that much time into it.
It's absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, and you, I will say that to pursue the real ending, you have to make a very difficult decision, like emotionally difficult. Like there's something that about it where you're just like, I kind of don't want to do this. I like where things are now. It's not perfect, but I'm happy here. But to get like that true resolution, you have to kind of make a deep cut. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the fact that it does that to you. It's like, oh, everything's great. You've found your resolution. Now it's time to break your heart.
We have to wrap up soon. Before we go, though, I want to ask you guys, what do you not like in this game that's traditional, and what do you want from Dragon Quest XII? I think I've articulated my points pretty well throughout this. Again, Sugiyama, put him in the corner, give him a little like play school piano, tell him he's making a game, and you know, he'll work it out. And then just hire somebody that's good at music and is not racist or homophobic or anything like that. So, yeah, get rid of him, number one. Number two, it would be great if it was a seamless game, you know, no loading screens or anything like that. But I feel like, yes, keep things – keep tradition but still keep modernizing because, again, when I played 8, I'm like, well, they can't go anywhere from here. This is like the most modern experience ever. But now 8 feels super dated compared to this, and I feel like they can keep changing with the time. So I'm excited about 12. It will come out when I'm like 70 years old probably at the rate they're making these games. But yeah, I feel like they're headed in the right direction. I just wish the music was better. How about you guys? Like, what don't you like about the tradition in the series, and what do you want to see in 12?
I mean, aside from the tinny music quality, there's really nothing in 11 that I don't like.
Mm.
But at the same time, I wouldn't mind seeing 12 go more in the direction of 9, sort of like a, you know, play it your own way with your own avatar.
I'd like that too.
Job-based systems and things like that, more open-ended. I really enjoy that, and I'd love to see that explored in this sort of high-spec approach. I think it's boring when Dragon Quest is just the same thing every time, so I like for them to kind of mix things up. And now that they've really found such a great expression of the concept that was, you know, sort of the foundation of Dragon Quest VIII, I would like for them to go to the next game and say, like, how can we do 9 but make it even fresher, more modern, better looking, you know, more refined, more playable, add some more quality of life to it. That would make me very happy.
I am one of those very traditionalist Dragon Quest fans who was also very pleased by this game. But I think I kind of never want a Dragon Quest game to be not turn-based. I want them always to be turn-based. Mm. Like that is just – that's like Mario is a platformer. This is a turn-based
We've got Builders now as the action RPG. We don't need them to do that in the mainline series. Now we have a Dragon Quest action RPG. It's all good.
So yeah, I hope that never changes. And I mean, yeah, just it's more about just like further streamlining things and updating. By the time a 12 comes out, it's like 2024, and what even are games then?
What is the world even?
But I also hope, you know, actually one thing I didn't mention that I love so much about this game is that Dragon Quest is never the prettiest game on a console. Like every time before this, it's never – maybe 8 was really good looking. But this was such a gorgeous game. It is Unreal 4 as hell. But it's like just shiny. Like every – the polished veneer of every like texture, I was just like,
yeah.
God, this, I love how gorgeous it is.
I do wish that the environmental design were more in line with the character design, mm-hmm. where it feels like you've got – fairly realistic looking environments and then very Toriyama looking characters, I wouldn't mind a bit more cartoon appeal to the environmental design.
Yeah,
but
well,
that's a minor
complaint.
Well,
that's why they turned up the realism slightly on the design, just so it wouldn't to work
on
bloom
that lighting kind of, and the cell shading and stuff to kind of bring it together. But I still feel like, you know, the texture work and the design work just need a little more. Like, look at how Breath of the Wild handles it. It's that's a game that has a very consistent art style between characters and world and everything. I wish that Dragon Quest 12 or 11 were a little more like that.
I kind of like the dysfunction of those visual styles. I liked that a gorgeous shiny Unreal 4 brick was used to make ridiculous looking Toriyama characters, or that how metal slimes now have this like realistic chrome to them. I really like that a lot. And yeah, I think it's just it's now about just like polishing the brass basically on this beautiful ship called Dragon Quest for me. Like, I don't think it needs a major change anytime soon. This was the update it needed. I hope they did have one of those press releases about how well it sold. They said like it sold now 4 million copies. But this was a worldwide pronouncement, so it's just like, well, does that mean it only sold like 800,000 in America or whatever?
Probably.
Which
that's still pretty good.
I think I read that it's the best-selling Dragon Quest in America of all time.
Okay, wow. Well, because I know, I believe it was 9 past a million. I think they could get 9 past a million, and that's the highest sold.
Okay, so maybe it's up there, but you know, it was a multi-platform release, so that's going to help.
Yeah, no, the PC version, it being the first one on PC, I think really opened some doors too.
For sure.
What a major moment that is for Japan in the last 5 years for major publishers like Square, Capcom, Konami to realize we could sell this on Steam and make money. Like Sega publishing Valkyria Chronicles, I don't think we'd have a Valkyria Chronicles 4 if they hadn't published it on Steam and saw people actually buy it.
Sega's putting everything on Steam, like Vanquish and Bayonetta, things like that. It's great. Great for everybody.
Well, didn't Resonance of Fate just come out on Steam?
Yes, it did.
You must be so happy.
Oh my God. People can finally play the game now. Yeah, forget about Dragon Quest 11.
Wait, no.
Actually, I like Resonance of Fate more, but that's another podcast.
Wow.
I just betray this entire podcast. Yeah. I'm sorry, but
yeah,
I'm so sorry,
too.
Everyone. I didn't mean to for the last minute backstab, but I guess that's very Dragon Quest. Also,
I
was actually the villain here the whole time, and you didn't realize.
Enough of these mechanics that are easy to understand. I'm going to play Resonance of Fate. But thanks for joining us, folks, for this episode of Retronauts. If you want to help support the show and get some cool stuff, go to patreon.com/retronauts. And for $3 a month, you can get every episode of this podcast a week ahead of time and ad-free. And at a higher bitrate, it's the ideal way to listen to Retronauts. It's not a lot of money, and it helps support our show. All that money goes to us producing the show, and it's a great little – we offer great incentives for you to give, and we really appreciate anything you can give. And at higher levels, there are more rewards, physical rewards, things like that. So yes, even if you can only give $1 a month, we really would appreciate it. We need every penny we can get to keep this going into the future. We have to cover Dragon Quest 12 when it comes out.
Yeah.
So we have to still have to be around for that. Everybody else, please let us know where we can find you.
Okay, I'm Jeremy Parrish, and you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. Although, as you can hear in this episode, I'm hardly spiteful about video games at all. And I also have a separate Patreon that I might as well promote. It's for Retronauts. It's my Video Chronicles Patreon. NES Works, Game Boy Works, Super NES Works, and Virtual Boy Works, by God.
Oh, God.
I'm tracking the chronology of all these platforms. I kind of alternate between systems. Virtual Boy is going to be done in its entirety because it's only 20 games. And so you can look forward to that. That's patreon.com/gamespite. Otherwise, you can find me at retronauts.com, and also I'm doing stuff with Greenlit Content these days, and so you'll find me there doing stuff with their properties. Some of the stuff you won't even see because it's secret.
Ooh. What's happening?
And I'm HENEREYG on Twitter. You can follow me there for all my thoughts on games. Like, boy, it was a tough week for me when Spider-Man and Dragon Quest came out at the same time. That was not a fun. That was my birthday week. But anyway, yeah, you can find me on there talking about video games. But if you love hearing me on podcasts like this one, talking to people like Bob Mackey.
Me?
You should follow my podcast we do together.
Wait, now they're your podcast, Henry.
Well, wait a minute. Okay.
There are podcasts.
You should follow our podcast.
Thank you.
Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. We go through every episode of The Simpsons in chronological order with tons of cool guests. We're entering season 9.
So it's like an NES works, but for cartoons?
It's true.
There's a series of lawsuits happening at once here.
And What a Cartoon is we do the same for a different animated series each week, like Gargoyles, Batman the Animated Series, Steven Universe, even anime like Cowboy Bebop. You should listen to all those and support us on our Patreon, patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
Thank you so much for listening, folks. We'll see you soon for another brand new episode of Retronauts. Thanks for listening.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile's super reliable, super fast nationwide network and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.